You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Alex Braidwood. Alex, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Alex, I'm talking to you from Ames, Iowa. That's where you are, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yep, I'm a professor at the Iowa State University here in the College of Design.
So tell me a little bit about what you're working on now. I want to talk about listening instruments and sound and noise and how you came to that. But just before we go backwards maybe and talk about how you got involved with all of this, is there a project you're working on right now concerning your work?
Yeah, so I'm starting to lay the groundwork for some things that I'm going to be doing next summer once I get kind of back out into some of the prairie and wetland preserves of northwest Iowa. So kind of heading into winter here, I've started laying the groundwork for a different kind of like on-site audio and learning experience where, I can use this sort of project as both a way to continue documenting some of these natural soundscapes, but also bring that into noisy environments in order to create like a workshop space. So I've been investing kind of a lot of time in putting together these active listening and nature sound workshops for people of all ages. And so this the stuff that I'm working on now is really actively taking that workshop idea as a way to engage an audience in my art practice to another level.
Okay, so let's just to go a little more into that. What does that exactly mean? I mean, maybe you could walk us through what a workshop would be like, what students would experience, or if you want, tell me how that would translate to an audience in your own art.
Sure. Yeah. So I do a couple of different workshops, kind of depending on the amount of time that's available and the age range of the people doing it. So one of the workshops that I've done the most is called the Listening Instruments Invention Workshop. And this works for people of all ages. I've done it as young as like kindergarten and first graders who come in with their parents or guardians. And I've done it all the way up through high school, college, and even with like, sort of working professionals, of all ages. And the idea with these, with the Listening Instrument Invention Workshop, is an extension of a project that I started a while ago. It's called the Noisolation Headphones. And so that project looks at using materiality and the design of a physical object to transform an individual person's relationship to their acoustic environment. And so what it does is it manipulates the sounds wherever you are, basically like turning your surrounding environment into a performance through the material characteristics of how the device is built. So the invention workshop.
Give me an example of that, because that's not like completely clear. What would like walk me through what the materiality, what the invention would be, what the object, how that happens.
Okay, sure. So basically, it's like imagine a pair of like earmuffs that you would wear to protect yourself from something loud, like if you're in like a wood shop or if you were going to go shoot a gun or something. So headphones that are just like sort of a large plastic dome that are intended for hearing protection, not necessarily headphones that would not headphones that would have a speaker in them. And so I take those and then I attach different like drill holes in them and then attach different materials, most commonly copper piping, in order to then manipulate how the sounds approach the listener's ear. So it's this intervention between the listener's ear and the sounds that are happening.
So the listener could be, I'm sorry to interrupt, so the listener could be in nature or hearing other certain sounds produced, and then as you change these kind of earmuffs, noise canceling, well, maybe that's the wrong word, right? But mm-hmm. Yep. the kind of muffs, the cups or the headphones over the ears then kind of mitigate the sounds, and so they start, you're hearing different sounds as we change the materials that we put into these headphones.
Correct. Yeah. So it's a transformation. Okay. And I refer to it as being anti-cancellation, because we've gotten quite good at blocking out sound with, some pretty fancy noise cancellation technologies. And we've also gotten really good at blocking out sounds that we don't want to hear by covering it up with other louder sound. So putting on, music headphones and turning them up really loud. But the idea with these projects is to use this idea of the headphone space not to block out or cover up the sounds, but to transform the sounds so that it becomes a different kind of engagement with whatever environment you're in. And so the workshop gives people a chance to invent their own listening instruments, their own set of, you know, interventions, where putting them on and building them out in different ways, sometimes in groups, sometimes individually, allows them to experience all the sounds that are happening around them in a different way. And it includes different kinds of exercises, like developing listening maps as a way to visualize the things that they're hearing, and also just having conversations.
Wait, say that again. Developing listening masks, did you say?
A listening map, like drawing a map of what sounds are happening in their environment.
So what does that mean? Let's talk about that a little bit. What does that mean to? Because I'm getting the sense of it now, and whether it's children or adults in these workshops, where you know, it's almost like changing filters on glasses or something. Only we're talking about audio, and we're hearing the environment in a different way. And it would make sense that there's ways that we might prefer to alter it as opposed to others, which is so interesting. So what is the listening map, though? What does that mean, and how do they make that?
So they, you know, it's just a lot of times it's just like marker on paper, and the idea is to spend time focusing on what we're hearing and document it. Because again, not only are we good at like covering it up or blocking it out, but we're also good at just ignoring stuff. We have kind of trained ourselves to ignore background sounds or you know, kind of forget about things, or just plain not notice stuff that's happening. And so having this exercise of developing a map of what people are hearing gives us a different kind of engagement with our listening abilities, which we know from music studies can improve. And so one of the things that's really interesting in the workshop is to kind of see where people start and where they end. So if we do a listening map at the beginning and then continue our discussion, do the exercises, maybe do a sound walk or build out the headphones, and then do like another map at the end, looking at the differences between them can be really telling about what did people notice initially and what did they notice after they sort of participated in the activities. The other thing that can be really interesting is developing these listening exercises while wearing the modified headphones. So that gives people a very different engagement, because sounds come to the ears, you know, the ears in different ways. Different frequencies resonate depending on what kind of choices that people have made with their invention. Sometimes sounds that are far away sound much closer. Sometimes close sounds sound much farther away. And so this processing of how these things sound familiar but still different draws the attention to the soundscape in a new way.
So the people who come to the workshop are leaving the workshop with a custom made set of I don't want to call them headphones. What do you call them?
Yeah, well, I refer to them as modified headphones.
So do they leave with a modified set of headphones? Because that's fascinating.
I have done that in the past, but that is like a funding intensive way to do the workshop. So generally, it's more about them leaving with the experience and the mapping and the you know, some of the ideation exercises that we've done. As far as like the materials for the headphones, I've got like a kit of parts that I can bring in, and so I can come into like a middle school classroom, or I can come into a summer day camp and just kind of like, you know, have this exercise ready to go. But not very frequently do they actually leave with the things that they make. Instead, it's more about kind of playing with them in the moment, and then, you know, sort of experiencing them in whatever space we are in.
It sounds like it could create a kind of almost, I don't want to overstate this, but a sort of revelation of what it means to hear and what natural sound is or isn't, you know, just in the way that visual art ideally impacts the viewer in a similar way, where we're surprised at what we're seeing, where we can't understand what we're seeing, and that changes the way perhaps we see throughout the day or throughout our lives, or it can, ideally. It would seem listening, you know, it's such a, and especially natural sounds and the way you've written about it, all these sounds that we sort of avoid during the day or are attracted to or, you know, kind of make disappear in our own way, it seems like it could have a profound effect on a workshop, participant is what I'm saying, and trying to get at what that effect would be. But it's even, you know, sound is such a hard thing in a way for me to grasp and to talk about. I can talk more about like a similar effect with visual art, but sound seems, I don't know, almost more, it kind of digs into you deeply right away, right? We just hear these things. We can't really shut off our ears. They come right to us. We can close our eyes and not look at art, but sound, this is like such a profound part of what shapes, I don't want to say who we are, but what we think we're living in or around. So what happens when participants leave these workshops? Have you ever had an experience or recall a story of someone really feeling differently about the world they live in?
Yeah, and I actually have had several, you know, exactly sort of what you're saying about the power and the impact of our hearing and listening and how those two things work, and in some cases even how they're so different. You know, this idea that our ears don't shut off, that we hear in 360 degrees, is a, you know, that premise is a huge baseline for where my work extends from, because the sounds that we put out into the world as designers and as makers of things are equally as crucial as the visual things. And so when people sort of come to that realization in the workshop, it can have a profound effect. And I've had several people email me, like, you know, hours, days, weeks, months later, and say, I hear things in my world in a totally different way. And, you know, along these lines of like having kind of a new realm opened up to them. And it's really fascinating to see people's sort of quick transition to a new kind of connection to their environment, and then how that sustains, you know, over time. And one of the places that I have done these workshops is with designers and design students who are responsible for putting things out into the world, as a way to say, like, hey, consider the sounds that you're putting out in your products and in your objects and in your, you know, in your different, you know, in the different ways that you're working, because these things are really important. And if we're not careful, sound does become very invasive because of all those reasons you were mentioning about how, you know, how our sense of hearing and listening doesn't turn off. And we know that from lots of different, you know, we know that kind of from lots of different perspectives, including evolutionarily. You know, sound gets a lot of credit, our ability to hear, I should say, gets a lot of credit for our evolutionary development, because we can go to sleep and we can rest in the night. Yet if a tiger is about to pounce, we can wake up because we'll, you know, we can hear these things happen. And it's a similar kind of thing where, you know, even when you're sleeping, your mind is working. And you know, we know that through parents being able to sleep through some sounds, but even like the faintest sound of a child can wake a parent up.
Right.
So there's kind of a lot happening there in this channel that is essentially like always open all the time and in all directions.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating world, really. And I mean, when you talk about all these sounds and working with designers, that seems so important, because there are these kind of odd default sounds that we know. What comes to mind to me is the iPhone ring that's probably from 4 or 5 years ago that is the default ring, and we hear in movies and everywhere that da 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 whatever it is, and it's sort of you know, awful and seemed very unconsidered in a way, you know, but it's something that's part of our I don't know, audio vocabulary. So so you know, it seems so important, yeah, for designers especially to think about that. And so let's talk about how you got involved in this. This is such an unusual field. It's I mean, I've talked to other musicians and people working with sounds in different ways, but your angle and the way you're coming from it is, it seems to be much more than just not that it's just, but you're not only an artist making, you know, work and experiments, but it also has this kind of impact on the design world as kind of research. How did you get involved in this initially?
So I've always been, you know, I kind of have always been interested in music. And my undergraduate degree and a big chunk of my background is in graphic interaction and motion design. And so when I was in, you know, that world heavily as a professional interaction and motion designer, I always really enjoyed working on the sound aspect of the things that we were building and designing. So sound effects for motion graphics and, you know, interface sounds on different sort of web and, you know, sort of spatial experiences and things like that. And then I just started getting really interested in issues related to noise pollution, specifically connected to my interest in being outdoors. So I also grew up camping. I'm an Eagle Scout. I still do, you know, like backpacking trips and things like this. And this idea of like noise pollution and nature sound and being outdoors and like the built environment was really like triangulating things that I was interested in. And initially it started out as an interesting way for me to investigate the places where I was going, where I just, a decade and a half ago, I just started carrying around a sound recorder. And anytime I would go to a new city, I would always give myself enough walking around time. If I was in town for business, I would leave my hotel an hour early in the morning in order to wander this other way to, you know, see what kind of sounds were over near the train tracks or whatever. I would just look at maps and wander with my ears and capture these things. And so then I started kind of collecting those and then realized that there was a way to do this outdoors as well, and that I could spend time out, you know, sort of in the woods or in the prairies or in the mountains and record these natural sounds. And as I was really looking at from like the perspective of an interaction designer, I got kind of focused on how people were using headphones and portable devices in the sort of early days of like as like portable MP3 players were transitioning to smartphones. I got really interested in how people were using those smartphones in ways that simply mimicked other ways of playing audio. Like there was an analog to radio, there was an analog to a Walkman or a Discman. But I thought it would be really interesting to start investigating both the device and the headphones for the things that they had capabilities to do. So I started building like apps that would play sounds based on what the camera was seeing. I was building apps that were performing noises based on your GPS location and direction and speed of travel and things like this. And so then that's where these like headphone experiments really came to play, were this as a lineage of this experimentation of what portable devices and headphones were doing to the sound, to people's relationship to their soundscape in public spaces on public transportation as they walk down the street and things like that. And then from
I want you to go on, but just to talk about those apps for a minute. So the apps that you were making were ways of, like you're saying, GPS-driven sound. You're ascribing a certain amount of sounds or instructions to, let's say, GPS device. So it plays different notes or sound as it moves around. It's not something that's orchestrated beforehand. It's a whole new set of sounds that are triggered by different things that are happening within the GPS. Is that what's going on?
Correct. Yeah. So the app itself would sound different at any different place around the world. The app would sound different because of your GPS location, and then if you're walking or driving, you know, all of these things would come into be factors in how the sound moves forward. Yeah. Yep.
I mean, it would really be wonderful, it seems, to have you. So there isn't an app that can, you know, do you have an app that someone can actually use on their phone now to interact with the environment in another way?
No. These were some kind of like Android things that I did a few years ago, and I haven't really moved forward with those.
Move forward with what you were saying. There were the apps, and that moved you more towards other ideas about the environment.
Yeah, yep. So that's where then, you know, sort of building out these headphones, developing different ways for people to engage with these headphones, and then looking at nature sound and really like thinking about the value of documenting the sounds of natural environment and then learning more and more about the biology and the impact of human noise on some of these natural environments, learning about how you can sort of assess the well-being of an environment based on the things that are happening there acoustically. And so that's been the thrust of my work for the last couple of years, has been returning to sites and documenting them from year to year in order to look at some of the differences, using those recordings to develop audio for release online, and also developing multi-channel installations that people can experience. And then continuing along that line of like the connection to the environment and sound, utilizing those sounds along with some other sonification techniques to turn water quality data. Because I'm in Iowa, water quality is a huge issue with the things that are happening with the riverways here, the amount of nutrient runoff and things like this that are happening with the industrial agriculture. And the impact that it's having on the waterways all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, utilizing water quality data in order to create sound and musical compositions has been like a thing that I've been working on recently as well.
And so talking about that water quality data to create musical composition, how, and considering that this is also a kind of political issue locally for you, how will that reach your audience or impact your audience? Because now it sounds like there's in that particular project, we're talking about something that's of political, ecological importance. How will it interact in that way, in a sense? How will that that reflect the situation that you're in there in terms of water? Or teach the people there, or the audience, mm-hmm. or the local population, something that could be helpful?
Yeah, you know, it's because it's so politicized, that's part of where my inquiry started. You know, when people talk about the nutrient levels in the water and things like that, and knowing kind of what the acceptable levels are, you know, my thought going in was like, okay, so it's bad sometimes, but like, how bad is it, and how long is it bad, and things like this. And so one of the data sets that I started with was like 1 year of nitrogen data. And I was just curious, so I was able to find sampling data from the Des Moines River for the entire year, and decided that I was going to use this baseline that the EPA has set of 10 parts per million is the acceptable level. So anything over 10 parts per million, they have to kick on this sort of extra filtering and cleansing technology. And so I was curious, like, how much of the year is it actually above 10 parts per million? So I developed a few different ways of visualizing and sonifying this in order to experience the data in a different way. And it was very telling. It was, you could see the times of year when it got really bad. You could see how much of the year it was bad. And so it just becomes part of the story of trying to understand, trying to help people understand, like, what is bad and how bad is bad? Because otherwise things kind of get bandied about in these, like, high-level soundbite kinds of ways, or there are these, you know, incredibly complicated charts or graphs or things that are maybe more difficult to relate to. But the idea of turning this data into sound is about providing a different way for both the public and the researchers even to experience their data. And so one of the areas that I work with this, it's actually a celebration of how good the water is. So it's a lake here in Iowa. The water quality is good, and it's actually more interesting to hear how the water changes and how the characteristics of the water change over the course of the different seasons. There's always a couple of different, you know, stories going on there with, like, sometimes it's more about understanding what's happening in the water and how maybe the elements are related to each other. And then the other is specifically thinking about the impact that, you know, different industries are having on the quality of the water itself.
That's so interesting, as a form of activism and education, that seems so important. How do you see the future of this kind of work? In talking to you and reading over what I had of your work and just hearing what you're saying now, it seems that this type of work and just attention to noise and sound, how it impacts us, how it can, you know, illustrate and inform us on issues, seems to be at its infancy, right? I know there are other artists working maybe in slightly similar veins, but it seems that in terms of just design impact in the world, that this could be used much, much more than it is now. Is that the case, or am I just kind of naive and overreaching there?
I think that some of that is very true, because I think, you know, we are, you know, we're at a point where I think we're just really culturally starting to understand the impact that, you know, that different kinds of noise, different types of unwanted sound can have on us. You know, the studies are starting to be more and more clear about the health impacts of noise. We're starting to understand better about, you know, sort of like the quality of the soundscape of our own living environment, the quality of soundscape in the natural environment, the impact that it has there. And so my hope is that this kind of work does continue to grow and expand and help draw people's attention to this, you know, this issue that does, you know, it adds to things that we're starting to understand. Noise and its relationship to stress and all the things that stress causes in our bodies. Noise and its relationship to our, like, mental ability to focus or our own sort of well-being. Noise and its relationship to a designed environment like healthcare or education. You know, all these things where we're talking about knowledge transfer, where we're talking about, you know, experiences both in, like, communal and individual private settings. We're still, like, learning all of these things similar to how we were learning about air pollution in like the 70s and 80s and how long that kind of took to really become something that people valued or considered an issue. And I, you know, we're kind of at that point now. And my hope then is that not only through like my own work, but through this idea of working at the intersection of art and science, we can start to sort of bridge some of that divide where, you know, science is really good at speaking amongst itself, but there's a lot of really important things that don't always cross over into the public sphere, into the public discourse. And so both like working with specifically ideas of like noise and nature sound, but also at this, you know, with this idea of like art and science provides this space that I think is going to continue to expand.
That's fascinating. It's so interesting to talk with you, and thank you for doing this work. Before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading at the moment. I'm most curious what people are reading.
Yeah, so actually the book that I'm just about to finish, it's called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and it's by a guy named Yuval Harari, and it's amazing. It's, you know, it's sort of a high-level history of where we come from as humans, but it breaks it down in these really interesting ways where it talks about, like, how communities have formed over the millennia. It talks about ideas of, like, how did we get to our currency system? How did people sort of move and adjust from continent to continent? What are different ways in which religions formed and the impact that that had on cultural groups? And so, yeah, so it's a really, really fascinating book.
You know, that's so interesting you say that, because that's been mentioned a few times before, enough so I bought the book and I'm halfway through it now. And I also think it's an extraordinary book, really fascinating, but there's something about it. And just, I mean, I'd like to hear your feeling about it. I feel like there should be a support group for people reading that book or something, because there's something about it that gives me an almost kind of melancholy feeling. And maybe that's not quite the right word, but the way he lays it out, it's so clear in a sense, and it's also this idea that everything comes from fictions and stories that we tell, and that from, you know, human rights to laws to all these things, these are ideas that are made up so that we can you know, manage ourselves in groups, as is religion and capitalism and all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
For me, you know, that makes me feel like I'm not sure what the exact feeling is, but that we're these apes that are you know, have bumbled through a number of iterations, and basically, you know, we kind of make one mistake after another. The mistakes are just compounding with us, starting with, you know, the agricultural revolution, and things just keep getting worse and worse. And we're not talking about global warming or anything like that. We're just talking about the way our species evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that upsetting at all, or is that just me?
Well, so through sort of just a weird set of circumstance, I'm usually trying to read like both at the same time. I generally have like a fiction book going and a nonfiction book going. And so this was the fiction book. And just before I started reading Sapiens, through just sort of a random, you know, sort of Amazon wish list coincidence, the nonfiction book that I started and finished was Ishmael, which, if you read, do you know that one?
I know that, but I haven't read it, yeah.
Okay, so I was reading these at the same time, and Ishmael spends a lot of time about talking about our culture. You know, it's fiction, but it's an interesting sort of like series of thought experiments about how we got to where we are. And so my takeaway from both Ishmael and Sapiens was a reminder that we are not in like the end-all be-all, and that we've gotten here because of a whole bunch of things that have happened. But it actually made me feel really positive, because I have been feeling like we're in kind of a rough spot right now. We're sort of like in a really tumultuous time with the way like culture has shifted, and the, you know, sort of, you know, the different things that are happening politically, this like super strict and sort of like growing divide between not just like classes, but cultures and people from different economic backgrounds and things like that. Different education, like education seems to be a growing divide amongst some of these groups. But there was some, my takeaway from it was actually something really positive, in that it's a reminder that it is built by people, that it is sort of made up, and that we have the potential to continue to grow and to continue to make it up and to change it moving forward, whether that happens through, you know, sort of like accident or intention. But it gave me a bit of hope about not thinking that like, oh, this is the end, because this was what everything was building up to. And that we're in the middle of kind of an empire that is almost on the brink of collapse, in which something else will develop out the other side.
Thank you, Alex. I'd like to leave it at that note. That's I appreciate you saying that, and that's very interesting. Thanks so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate the work that you're doing and your time.
Yay, thanks for the nice words, and thanks for the opportunity. It was really great talking with you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.